can see the effects of it. Everything from acidification of waters to warming of waters impacting our fisheries.
Alaska senators react to President Obama's climate change plan. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, June 26th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Galena residents rebuild.
I've been here almost 3 weeks now, and every day it's been a struggle to allocate time, and you only have so much energy, and by the end of the day your hands just ache and your arms are sore.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
As an active senior, your independence is important to you. One of the ways for you to maintain your independence is to reduce your risk of falling. A fall risk assessment can be part of your initial or annual Medicare exam. They'll ask about your vision and review your medications for possible problems. Learn ways to improve balance, strengthen muscles, and reduce hazards at home. Contact your Medicare provider for an appointment. This message in good health is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
President Barack Obama is laying out his framework for combating climate change. If successful, it could be a major accomplishment and part of his legacy. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, the president is bypassing Congress, and the delegation has mixed reaction.
The president has said he wants to reduce carbon emissions as a safety net for future generations. And that's why he chose to lay out his new plans on Tuesday to college students at Georgetown.
I refuse to condemn your generation and future generations to a planet that's beyond fixing.
He plans on attacking climate change from many flanks, regulating CO2 emissions at power plants, funding renewable energy projects on federal land, international agreements, and making cities safer from future weather changes. That last one gets the praise of Senator Mark Begich, who calls Alaska ground zero for climate change.
We see the effects of it, everything from acidification of waters to warming of waters impacting our fisheries to permafrost melt, and we see it all.
Begich neither criticizes nor praises the president's plan. He says he supports anything that protects the environment, but focus should be elsewhere right now.
I think the broader issue we should be focused on is a large energy plan.
The most controversial measure would regulate coal plant emissions, something never done before. The president wants the EPA to draft a rule next year and enact it in 2015. He does not specify what the new standards would be, and he does not need congressional approval. He can force the rule changes from his office. Senator Elise Murkowski dismisses the tactic.
When you try to advance legislation that is going to have a detrimental effect on the economy, it's going to be tough to gain legislative support in this body. So I think the president is looking at this and saying, well, we'll go in the back door.
She says it could be bad for the economy because the new regulation could potentially increase the cost of electricity. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
It's been nearly a month since an ice-choked Yukon River overflowed its banks and flooded Galena. The icebergs have melted, and the river looks docile, but many people remain displaced by what it did. Most flood refugees are living outside the village, but as KUAC's Dan Ross reports, more and more are coming back to rebuild their lives.
Looking out on the sun-cooked tarmac at Fairbanks Airport, the ice jam flood that hit Galena just a few weeks ago is hard to fathom. Lucille Silas, one of hundreds of Galena residents who evacuated to Fairbanks, is waiting to fly home, scanning through flood pictures on her phone and expressing relief at being spared the worst.
My house made it. Yeah. And I live right by the river. There's the river by my house.
So when you say it made it, did it have damage? Or?
No damage to my house, but to the garage.
Silas's house is livable, but that's not the case for hundreds of others that were shifted, crushed, and soaked by the flood.
It's like shoved back 20 feet and over, and it's so on the ground that I don't even know how we're going to get things underneath it out.
Allison Ismalka's riverfront home is a total loss. She's living at Bureau of Land Management barracks with her husband and volunteering at a depot set up to distribute donated clothes, food, furniture, and other supplies. Galena is still grieving from the disaster and noting reports of stealing, as Melka says people are dealing with the loss differently.
Even though we're really helpful with each other when we have trouble or setbacks in the community, now it's the whole community that's had the setback. And I think sometimes we forget that we need to take time to heal and rejuvenate how we are as a community and how we work as a community.
Esmelka doesn't want to leave Galena, so while waiting to see how government programs can help with rebuilding, she's focused on being helpful and welcoming friends home.
Hi.
Thank you.
Are you?
Locals largely reject the costly and uprooting idea of moving the village to higher ground. 10-year Galena resident Tim Bedoni, like most, is just trying to get things together enough so his family can come home. There's a lot to do, and he celebrates small victories like setting up the chickens.
So I built a kind of a hillbilly chicken coop operation over here out of junk that was within like a 10-foot radius. So I just sort of looked around and grabbed something and nailed it to another thing and built a little place for these guys. Princess, Goldie, and Queenie, who survived the flood of 13, living in a dog kennel on a freezer for a couple days, and they gave me an egg for the first time this morning. So good job, chickens.
The chickens are feeding on mosquitoes that have come out in abundance from standing flood ponds.
All right, Tim, your mosquitoes are worse than we have.
Thank you. I'm honored. They are by far the worst I've ever seen. Far and away. One of the pluses would be that maybe with so much contamination in the standing water that it would have killed them, but not so.
It's a day off for Bedoni, who's feeling the strain of 20-hour days tearing out water damage and sorting through flood-soaked belongings, an ordeal both physical and mental.
I feel like if you spend 2 hours over here, you're not spending it over on your other stuff, and that's being neglected. And so I've been here almost 3 weeks now, and every day it's been a struggle to allocate time, and you only have so much energy, and by the end of the day your hands just ache and your arms are sore. And
Bedoni is Galena's volunteer fire chief, and he checks in on overhaul of the station, where a crew of mostly locals like teacher Tim Kalki are at work hustling against the short summer building season.
The contractor told me that his main goal is to get everything insulated and make sure that there's heat. Well, obviously winter's not far away. We're on the downhill slide after what, just 2 days ago. So that's definitely in the back of everybody's mind as we're chugging away here.
Every building and home in Galena is fronted by big piles of ruined insulation and drywall, trashed furniture and appliances. A mountain range of debris masks the clinic and city offices, where everything touched by sewage and fuel-contaminated floodwater is being thrown out. Most of it has to be trucked to the landfill far outside town, but wood is being burned in a portable incinerator. It's a waste of energy in a village where wood heat is a primary way to keep warm in the winter. A lot of residents lost their cordwood to the flood, but the river has also left behind uprooted trees for scavenge, an irony not lost on Bedoni.
We're united by the river, and that's a common topic of conversation that we can all relate to. You know, how's the river looking? Is it high? Is it low? How's fishing? And I think another thing that we all agree on is that it gives and it takes.
In Galena, I'm Dan Bross.
With yesterday's federal disaster declaration for areas affected by last month's flood, the state of Alaska has decided to close the disaster assistance centers that it had set up this week in Galena and in Circle. The DACs had been established to help people apply in person for state individual assistance. But anytime a disaster gets a federal declaration, state funding is nullified. As State of Alaska Public Information Officer Jeremy Zedek explains, the Federal Emergency Management Agency has its own protocol for applying for assistance.
The state sets up disaster assistance centers. FEMA sets up disaster recovery centers. The function is pretty much the same. With federal assistance, there is a separate application that will need to take place. And instead of making people fill out two applications, it was decided that we would only have one application processed. Residents will still have to apply for that FEMA individual assistance.
FEMA is expected to set up their centers in flood-affected communities in the coming weeks. A household that meets the qualifications for federal individual assistance may receive up to $31,900. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Cook Inlet Tribal Council gets into the video game business.
I really think this first consumer game is really going to look and feel unlike any game that's been out there.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
The Defense of Marriage Act has been ruled unconstitutional by the U.S. Supreme Court. This morning, the court issued an opinion saying that DOMA deprives people of equal liberty and protection as protected by the Fifth Amendment. The opinion was issued by Justice Kennedy, joined by Justices Ginsburg, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan. Phobian Peter Contessa and Amy Oliash are a same-sex couple from Juneau who were watching the case. The couple is heading to Washington State this fall to be married. After reading the ruling this morning, Peter Contessa says the impact is more powerful than she expected.
It's indescribable. Not something I expected to experience in my life.
Oliash says she had doubts about how the ruling would turn out after seeing how the court ruled in the Voting Rights Act case. She was following the decision online this morning, but says she had a hard time believing what she was reading.
I think my mind interpreted the words, but my emotions wouldn't let me go there.
The ruling means when the couple gets married in Washington, a state where same-sex marriage is legal, their marriage will be recognized under federal law. The mayor of North Pole is expressing concern about a proposal by the Fairbanks borough mayor to expand the city's water system into areas where an industrial solvent has contaminated groundwater. Meanwhile, two state environmental officers say they strongly support another proposal to quickly begin cleanup of sulfalane-contaminated groundwater in the North Pole area. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
North Pole Mayor Bryce Ward says it's certainly possible to expand the city's water system into areas where the groundwater has been sulfalane contaminated, but he's not sure that the city won't run into the same problem that it did back when the idea was first proposed, soon after officials with Flint Hills Resources announced in 2009 that sulfalane that had leaked from the refinery had been detected outside the facility's property.
The issue at that time was the annexation and whether or not people wanted to be a part of the community. And there's a very strong voice that the people did not want to be.
Ward says the alternative would be for residents of those areas to form a water service district, then build a system using money raised through service area fees. He says it's possible that such a system could be connected to North Pole's, but he sees the potential for problems and would prefer that residents of areas outside of town just agree to annexation.
That part of the community would have to become a part of the city of North Pole in order for us to service them with our utility.
The mayor says it's up to the people to decide which alternative they'd prefer, if either.
And ultimately, that's the will of the people. They'd have to decide what they would want. And if people are comfortable with the setup that they have now, I think that's a viable option, too. It just depends on what the community wants.
Ward questions whether either alternative is necessary, because he says there's already a solution in place, and that is the offer by Flint Hills to provide water to residents in sulfalane-affected areas.
Everyone that wants clean water has clean water, from my understanding. And I think that from, again, my understanding of what Flint Hills has done, they've done a great job at that.
Joyce Bonfoy is one of those who's accepted Flint Hills' offer. Bonfoy lives off Badger Road outside of city limits, and she says the company set up an alternative supply for her in 2011 after sulfalane showed up in a sample from her well.
I do have sulfalane, and so I opted to get the underground water tank.
Bonfoy is a retired nurse, and she says she showed up at Tuesday's open house meeting in North Pole set up by the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation because she wanted to find out more about the human health effects of sulfalane.
Because they don't know. Nobody knows the effect of it.
Not much is known about how sulfalane affects humans. Tests in recent years have shown that it harms animals that have been exposed to high levels of the chemical, but those tests are limited in scope and duration. The state DEC is working with researchers now that are continuing such testing, and the agency is getting assistance from experts with the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. I'm Tim Ellis in North Pole.
A regional nonprofit tribal organization is putting several million dollars into creating video games infused with Alaska Native values and culture. Cook Inlet Tribal Council is hoping to engage, empower, and educate young people, and to make money from what it says is the nation's first indigenous-owned video game company. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes has more.
Cook Inlet Tribal Council, or CITC, has become partners with E-Line Media, a New York-based video games developer and publisher. The joint venture is named Upper One Games, a play on the phrase Lower 48. Gloria O'Neill is president and CEO of both CITC and Upper One. She says CITC was looking for profitable business ventures and picked this one because it offers the opportunity to reach out to the next generation.
We are in a digital world now, and our young people, they've grown up around technology, and for the education community to be relevant and to connect with young people, that there will be different uses of technology that will be coupled with curriculum.
O'Neill says the first game they're launching is for all consumers and features an Inupiaq girl using strength, courage, and her reliance on others to survive in the Arctic.
What will be a part of this first game, the value of interdependence, which was based upon, a common theme within our communities as we all survived for 10,000 years together.
O'Neill says storytellers, artists, elders, and youth have all been part of the video game development process. She says they took the development team to Barrow to get a sense of the people and landscape there. E-Line founder and president Alan Gershenfeld says Upper One's first game will be unique.
I think when you look at that art style and the vision and the care and the craft that's going into it, I really think this is going to look, this first consumer game is really going to look and feel unlike any game that's been out there.
Upper One is also developing a game, Historia, which can be used as part of the study of ancient civilizations, a core course for seventh graders, and later games will be about social change. Gershenfeld says E-Line Media first met with CITC on just one project, but came to see that E-Line's mission of developing games that create gateways to new ideas, themes, and interests closely aligned with CITC's goal of building a sustainable business that could empower youth.
We bring very different skills and very different backgrounds, but we truly have a shared mission. And we realized, we could have manifested that just in a project or two, but we realized it's going to be much stronger if we build a portfolio, and if we're building a portfolio, we really want to kind of be in each other's shoes in terms of helping each other out at a company level.
Pitta Benz is Vice President for Social Enterprise at CITC and the Chief Operating Officer at Upper One. She agrees the partnership grew out of shared beliefs.
The story of what we're doing has resonated with people that have made tremendous amount of commercial success in their lives and are really looking to do something meaningful that they can be proud of and tell their kids that they're proud of.
Gershenfeld says his company brings a track record of success with games such as Pitfall, Mayan Adventure, Interstate 76, and the Tomb Raiders games to the partnership. He says E-Line Media will invest funds and help find funding for future games, which Ben says need to be successful.
We can't, make money for the organization and share our stories with the world if we don't have a fun game that people are going to buy. So we're really driven by, where are the opportunities for sales.
Upper One Games plans to release its first game in the fall of 2014. O'Neill says profits from the video games will be used to support other educational programs at CITC. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Don't wait to make your home more energy smart. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation's Home Energy Rebate Program will reimburse you for energy efficiency improvements. And if you don't have the upfront cash to make the investment, financing is available through Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Start saving money and energy today. Sign up at akrebate.com or call 877-257-3228. This message sponsored by AHFC. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Lawmakers are now trying to figure out what it would cost to implement a state-run health insurance program for public school employees. The Senate Finance Committee issued their call for studies this week, and they've set aside up to $350,000 to look at just how much the state's school districts are currently spending on private plans and if there would be any benefit to the state stepping in. The results they could get either bolster or sink legislation to have the state take over public school health plans. Senator Mike Dunleavy, a Republican from the Mat-Su area, sponsored the bill, and he says that it's in response to rising premiums.
If we can reduce the costs outside of the classroom, we could put more money inside of the classroom. That's the idea.
According to Department of Administration projections, it would cost the state more than $300 million a year to administer its own health insurance program for public school employees. Dunleavy says that the study should give legislators information on how expensive it would be to stick with the status quo.
The goal is cost savings. If there's no cost savings, and this is the best system we have, hey, we stay with it.
The Senate Finance Committee plans to reward their contract in July, and the final report on public school health plans will be due this fall. The city of Sitka canceled plans to create a temporary pedestrian mall along Sitka's main downtown thoroughfare. A group of community volunteers trying to boost the image of the city's central business district was trying to close the street for four consecutive Wednesdays to see if a street mall might appeal to visitors and locals. But the closure annoyed motorists and caused controversy in the Southeast Alaska community. KCAW's Ed Ronco has more.
This story begins on June 12th, right in front of St. Michael's Cathedral. A group of volunteers trying to revitalize Sitka's downtown got permission from the police department to block off part of Lincoln Street. The New Archangel Dancers performed, and some artists and merchants put their wares on display on tables. But not everyone was excited about the plan. Motorists complained about the detour. Some residents said they were not adequately warned about the closure, and some business owners outside those closed areas said traffic was diverted away from their storefronts. So, a few days later, the city said stop and suspended the closures until the assembly could talk about it, which brings us to Tuesday night.
Can I get a show of hands of how many people expect to come up and speak?
About seven people took Mayor Mim McConnell up on her offer. Rich McClear was one of them.
Advocates for pedestrian or walk-friendly communities say that a sidewalk has to have three zones.
One zone close to the buildings for chairs and benches and window shopping. Another zone for traveling, walkers, wheelchairs, etc. And a third zone for garbage cans and light poles and the things you need on a street.
It's impossible to get those three zones on the sidewalks in Sitka right now. It's just impossible. And without having that first zone close to the window shopping, I think it impedes the ability of people to look at stuff and buy things, to spend time pondering without blocking traffic.
McClear said he favored the closure because it meant more room for everybody. He also suggested closing the street only to parking instead of traffic altogether. Resident John Welsh also testified. He said he knew the plan wasn't perfect.
But it brings the community to the downtown. It possibly creates business, it makes it more exciting downtown. And what I saw was very favorable and positive. So I would ask you all to support it or continue experimenting with it, not completely shut it down.
On the other hand, Sitka Lutheran Church pastor Sandra Rudd said her congregation has concerns about access to the church, especially for worship services, weddings, and funerals.
Worship services and weddings are pretty predictable. Funeral services are not. I would hate to have to say to a grieving family, I'm sorry we can't have the service on the day you'd like because the street's closed.
Mary Stevenson said she wanted more clarity in the plan. What happens after the trial period?
Also, what is the success? What are we measuring the success or the failure of this? It's a success in the 1 and 200 block for the merchants, but it's a failure in the 3 and 400 block because they got totally cut off.
Then it was the assembly's turn. Tor Christensen.
I think it was worth a try.
all things being equal, I'd probably be willing to try it again, but there seems to be a lot of heartache about it, so yeah, we should probably figure it out for next year a little better. But
and Matt Hunter.
It could work. I think it's worth giving it one more try, and that's the way that you improve something, is you try it and you recognize parts that failed and parts that succeeded, and then you adjust and you try again.
And
I like the idea of it being closed permanently. So, you know, that's the extreme I come from.
Phyllis Hackett.
But, you know, I'm not really talking about me. I think that I have gotten a lot of comment on this, and I can say it's pretty well 50-50 of people liking it and people not liking it, and that's fine.
Eventually, the assembly voted to uphold the suspension of the street closures, at least for the Downtown Revitalization Group's particular effort. Doug Osborne, one of the leaders of the Downtown Revitalization Campaign, said there are other ideas to help Sitka.
I don't know that the group is married to any particular idea of how this revitalization looks, but the one thing I do think is that the group is very interested in trying ideas and very interested in looking at how we can make improvements downtown. Because the one thing I think that there would be consensus is that the status quo in our downtown was not working and that improvements needed to be made.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
Leonard Nimoy is taking a cruise through Alaska this week. KRBD's Layla Carey caught up with the actor on the downtown dock in Ketchikan and has this story.
From the final frontier to the last frontier. Leonard Nimoy paid his first visit to Alaska since 1972 this week, with stops in Anchorage, Seward, Sitka, Juneau, Skagway, and Ketchikan. He tweeted Tuesday announcing his cruise, and that inspired some fans in Ketchikan to wander around town in hopes of a sighting. KRBD was lucky to get a brief encounter with the actor, best known for his portrayal of Mr. Spock, a beloved and very logical character on the original Star Trek series. Nimoy, traveling with his family, says he's enjoyed his Alaska vacation.
We've had a fabulous time. It's a beautiful country, beautiful cities, great people. Fabulous time.
Nimoy is a passenger aboard the Silver Shadow. With help from Marco Torres, I'm Layla Carey in Ketchikan.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross and Jeremy Scott in Galena, Heather Bryant in Juneau, Tim Ellis in North Pole, Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage, Ed Ronco in Sitka, and Layla Carey in Ketchikan. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. Summer is a great time to schedule your child's checkup. This yearly visit lets you ask questions, track your child's growth, development, and overall health, and make sure your kids are up to date on their immunizations. Denali Kid Care and most insurance plans cover these visits, available from health care providers across Alaska. Students starting school in Alaska for the first time need a physical exam. So make your appointment for a well child checkup today. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. How do you get men to wear a life jacket when the fact is that 90% of those who die in boating accidents in Alaska are men? Well, most men won't listen to this message, but they might listen to you. So have them pledge to wear a life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. That's pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back home. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.